It is Saturday, May 27, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today, after a week in Geek, we focus on web development, Web 2.0, and the book, The JavaScript Anthology.
GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we're speaking with Cameron Adams about his new book, The JavaScript Anthology, 101 Essential Tips, Tricks, and Hacks. It's all about Web 2.0, web development, things of that nature. I've admired Cameron's website, The Man in Blue, for quite a while, and I look forward to speaking with him in just a moment. Of course, during the first half of the show, we'll welcome your during the second half of the show, we'll welcome your conversation, your voice, with conversation. Let me try this again. Let's do the theme again. Now I'm in the mood. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join the conversation. The phone number, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can get in the queue right now by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about half an hour. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance, Miles Elam, technical trainer at Surf Control, Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA, and on Skype from New York, Dee Dee Hubbard. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dee Dee. We also have on the line our guest who we'll be speaking with in just a moment, but, you guys. Sorry, I was so paid so much attention to Skype that I didn't pipe you guys up. All right, Miles, let's start the news today with you. Are you interested in doing the news first?
I just had a public service announcement, I guess.
Okay.
With regard to something that's making the rounds in political scenes, it's called net neutrality.
What this refers to is
a push by telecom companies and to some extent cable companies as well to charge more for certain content than others. In other words, let's say Google has a lot of material that they want to make available.
Oh, go on.
Right. Like, for example, video.google.com. And what they would want to do is, oh, hey, that's really popular. Let's charge more to guarantee that they have good bandwidth. But if they don't, if they just pay the normal price, then they get slower than some other commodity.
Analogous to toll roads, right? That's what kind of how the press is spinning this?
Well,
positioning.
See, the thing is, it's basically a snow job. You're looking at people are already paying for your bandwidth. Everyone pays for their internet access. You're paying for a modem. You're paying for a DSL.
Sure.
You're paying for cable. And then on the other end, you have Google, who pays an inordinate amount of money for
their bandwidth
mm-hmm. Being localized between different geographical regions and the amount of bandwidth they use. You know, they're paying a huge amount of money for that, and so charging more money to get access for what you already have is like, oh, we want to charge you twice for what you're already getting.
Why are the telcos doing this?
Well, it's a money grab.
Okay.
Well, that's not a very objective position, though, is it?
Well, it is. It is a money grab. There's no other way to explain it. They say that if they don't do this, then they won't be able to provide services to the internet as it grows, and that's just a crock.
Why is that? They get stuck with the bill to implement all the infrastructure that the rest of us take advantage
of. Except the fact that they didn't foot the bill for all the infrastructure.
Who footed the bill?
If, for example, with the phone companies, you had the U.S. government subsidizing that so that they could put a phone in everyone's home. It wasn't.
But nobody runs the internet on the phone system anymore. It's all
that's
run on fiber
optics. That's what DSL is.
DSL okay, is. DOL, plain old telephone system. But we're talking about the backbone stuff.
Additionally, the phone company, of course, is they're charging Google, which is not connected through phone system. They're connected through fiber. So
and you pay a fee for your DSL connection anyway, which
okay, so,
is not
right,
unreasonable.
So Miles and Didi, I'm assuming that you're really against this whole idea?
Right, and so is apparently the inventor of the BitTorrent protocol, BitTorrent client, which I can actually see very much his point of view. Now the people have talked about the peer-to-peer, which is the local ISP has a large amount of bandwidth before you even go onto the backbone. And so the issues of it would be too much bandwidth, we can't have high-definition content, suddenly becomes a moot point.
And your basic concept is your local ISP would have a BitTorrent server, and anybody that's downloading these shows, which you've got to start using BitTorrent or you can't really do this, they would just be getting it from the local ISP and the telco wouldn't have nothing to do with it. Okay, thank you.
Well, they'd have something to do with it, but the local loop.
Right.
Which is
thank you, Miles and Didi, for being so on our rights and what's going on politically. I appreciate that. I'm going to go over to Sean because I know there's a lot of news this week. Mr. Cleveland, hi.
First, Sean, tell us about the NVIDIA announcement, right?
Yeah, that's the biggest piece of news. That's right.
Man, I've been waiting all week.
Actually, I wanted to talk about it last weekend, but because this all happened the week before. But we didn't cover it on the show, and I don't think a lot of people understand that AMD launched a new processor architecture this past week. I don't know if the architecture changed that much, but the new processor takes advantage of DDR2 memory, which is next generation,
which is first for
memory
AMD.
Standard. Yes, so AMD integrates the memory controller onto the processor die, whereas Intel does not. They rely on a separate chip,
which is connected through Northbridge, or
that is in the Northbridge. Uh-huh. So the memory controller is in what's called the Northbridge, a separate chip. So when AMD wants to take advantage of new memory architectures like DDR2. They actually have to come out with the new processor architecture,
right.
Which is why Intel's been on DDR2 for a long time and AMD just got here.
Because they don't have to design a new chip on Intel.
Yeah, but right now, speed-wise, you're not going to see a lot of extra performance from this new chip. So if you're in an upgrade cycle, you need something faster, then I would recommend going to a DDR2 platform.
Going to Intel or AMD? You'd wait until the next chip from Intel. Huh?
So AMD's chip is just, it's great. It is lower power, which is really nice. It is quite a performer. It's dual core. They have the FX62. The FX line is their enthusiast high-end processor, runs at like 2.8 gigahertz.
Which means you can almost run the latest games.
You can run the latest games and then some.
So,
and then they have their X2 processor, which is more mainstream, but it's also dual core. But then Intel has announced they're coming out with a chip in another month or two. It's been codenamed Conroe, and they officially named it when AMD launched their chip. They said, hey, we're coming out with the chip 2, and it's going to be called Core 2 Duo. Core number 2 Duo.
So it's basically a marketing grab to announce it now, even though press have known about the chip for a little while.
Yeah.
Just to kind of squelch AMD's release.
Supposedly the press has chips.
Mm-hmm.
Hexas.net posted numbers.
And they're
really
good.
Upset a lot
so,
of people.
Yeah, you mentioned this concept, I think, before on GeekSpeak. Let me just clarify that you work for NVIDIA. You've known about this release for a while, but
I've been playing with the new AMD chip for a while. NVIDIA launched, I work for the platform group, which means I work on the motherboard chipsets.
And you made a big release.
That are called Enforce.
And you made a big release for this chip.
We did, yeah. We launched the Enforce 500 chip. And that's something I've been working on, and I'm really excited about. It's a high-end enthusiast chip is the 590 SLI. SLI is scalable link architecture.
It means two graphics cards.
Lets you
computer.
Run two graphics cards in a computer and take advantage of that performance.
I'm gonna kind of wrap this up because this, of course, is delaying our guest as well. But let me just clarify that a couple good cool things that I saw on this board when you were showing to me last night. You've got Windows integration with the BIOS, so you can actually modify your BIOS settings in Windows.
Yeah, there's a software called Intune 5.0. That does. It allows you to overclock your BIOS settings
for Windows.
Auto-tune.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got all kinds of neat features.
And the other thing
because
is,
we built the BIOS ourselves,
right.
NVIDIA did, on the Foxconn board.
And when you run a whole bunch of NVIDIA chips together on the board, NVIDIA graphics cards and all these different things, they speak to each other faster because of your own protocol that's not kind of available for everybody.
Right.
And therefore,
since NVIDIA makes the Northbridge, Southbridge, which we call the media communications processor, and... Yeah, so since we make those chips and we make the GPUs on the graphics cards, we're able to run them faster. It's called Link Boost to do that. And then we launched a new memory technology called SLI Ready Memory It takes advantage of this EPP technology that runs faster.
If you're more interested in this subject, please feel free to go to the GeekSpeak site, click on Sean Cleveland's profile, and go ahead and send him an email, because it's his job to talk about this. So we'll go on to the rest. Drew, I want to go ahead and let you have a news story before we get into our topic at hand.
I think it's an interesting news story. The 25 worst tech products of all time, PC World magazine did an article on it, and kind of, I don't know, not surprising, I guess, but I have to say that I used to be a customer. The number one worst tech product of all time, America Online.
Ah, interesting. Do they have the Newton on there from Apple?
They don't. They're in the top five is AOL, Real Networks, Real Player, which I absolutely sympathize with. That thing's insidious. An old false advertisement software program, Microsoft Windows Millennium 2000 is number four, and the Sony BMG music CDs that brought a... infected your computer when you put them in. So, AOL, and I quote here, and this is pretty scathing for a press article, it has never overcome the stigma of being the online service for people who don't know any better. Oh, stings. As a marketing guy, I'm cringing.
And actually, the Newton is in the honorable mentions for both the worst and the best.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Naturally.
One of the first PDAs with the handwriting recognition that didn't work. All right, so we've been hearing from Miles, Drew, Sean, and Didi's joined in a little bit. I'm not going to ask you, Didi, for news, and I'm going to stop the news at this point because I really want to talk to Cameron Adams. Cameron Adams has woken up at 3 a.m. He lives in Melbourne, Australia. I think he's a day ahead of us. We're talking to Cameron in the future. And he's connected via Skype. And Cameron, welcome to Geek Speak.
Welcome to the future.
Wow. You are loud. Let me see. Can you turn your mic down a little bit, just to pop your volume down a little bit? Cameron, thank you so much for joining us. I finally got your book, JavaScript Anthology, and it is just wonderful. It's 101 Essential Tips, Tricks, and Hacks for Programming JavaScript. And there's a lot of hype around Web 2.0, and I just wanted to You had this great speech about Web 2.0 at a conference you did recently. Can you kind of give us a summary about what Web 2.0 is?
Well, it means so much to so many different people, but I think Web 2.0 has just been sort of a build-up of all the technologies, and it's just in the past year or two they've really come together. And one of the key things about Web 2.0, I think, is this Ajax technology, which has allowed JavaScript to... sort of create this new paradigm of interaction with web pages, where you can update a tiny bit of a web page, but not have to do an entire page refresh. So Ajax and JavaScript has very much led this movement at the moment. As well, you've got all this other page design stuff like community building and getting people really involved with websites, which is also part of Web 2.0, but not exactly what my book's focused on.
Yeah, and one of the things that's kind of interesting about Web 2.0 and JavaScript in general is that really Web 2.0 is all about JavaScript in a lot of ways. It you can't do any of it without JavaScript. And the other thing is that all the technology behind what this Web 2.0 movement has been around, I think when Miles and I met each other, all these features were available in JavaScript 7 years ago.
In the very newest browsers.
That's true.
And that was the issue, was that you had so many browsers that couldn't do it, that it couldn't hit mass market.
So this show is definitely because I love web development, and I know that it's going to go over a lot of heads. Hopefully Drew will keep us on track a little bit so that no one gets lost. Drew, you lost yet?
Yeah, what's JavaScript and why do I care?
That's a great question. Cameron, please.
JavaScript is this brilliant new technology for introducing pop-up windows onto your computer.
Oh, fantastic, Cameron. I'm so glad we have you on the air to teach us about that. I can't live without another pop-up.
You know, that's so true. When it first came out, that's what it was.
Yeah, it's very much, it's gone from sort of this brilliant hero back in the late 90s, mid-90s, to a villain early 2000, and now it's suddenly become a hero again. Yeah. It just really encapsulates the revolutions that can occur on the web, so Web 2.0 is just a great sign that you can bring something back from the wild and make it popular once more.
That's basically what it is. It's a kind of a grassroots marketing thing. But let's go ahead and clarify, answer your question real well, Drew. HTML, everyone knows what HTML is. It's the markup language that makes web pages. So when you look at a web page, you're actually looking at something called HTML. There's a styling on top of that called CSS, which is actually the newest technology in the group that I'm going to mention. And that actually kind of allows the coloring and the stylizing, and it's pretty impressive. And then the last leg of all this stuff is JavaScript, and that's the programming language that runs in a web page. So when you're in a web page and things happen, let's say, for example, a window being popped up, it's normally JavaScript.
Well, actually, the what it was originally intended for, because pop-ups were more of an abuse of the technology, were things like validating forms, so that you didn't have to wait for a response back from the server. It could just show you a quick thing saying, oh, you're supposed to put a number in there, not a letter.
Yeah, that's a perfect example. So you fill out a form and you forget to put in your phone number, or you put in your credit card and it's not long enough. Sometimes you get a little pop-up message before the page goes away that says, hey, this doesn't look okay. That's an abuse of JavaScript.
That helps. And then what is Web 2.0 and how does that relate?
Well, that's when you make your form shake and shimmy and wind up and wind down.
Once again, an abuse of good technology.
The Richter scale.
The basic Web 2.0, we've seen it. Google Mail, Gmail, Google Maps, Yahoo's beta maps are all examples of Web 2.0. And basically, there's philosophy and technology that kind of merge together. And the technology visual of that is that you'll go to a website and you will edit something or change something, and instead of the entire page going away and reloading again, talking to the server in the back end, instead the page, only part of it will change and update. And that's basically a big part of the technology, and that's called AJAX.
Wow. So ultimately, this means that my browsing experience is more efficient, faster,
and that's why you care.
Well,
that's
really what you're looking is, with a web page, with just HTML, it's like print publishing. It's just, it's publishing a page.
Right, and you ask for another one, and you get another one.
Right, whereas AJAX or Web 2.0 is turning a web browser into an application format. In some ways,
it's very much like a desktop application.
Right. You can even think of it as the web browser becomes your operating system. I mean, is a very, I mean, it's not technically correct, but it's a good way of thinking about it. It's like a replacement for Windows.
It's a way that Google would be very keen to have you think about it.
Exactly.
And actually, we're seeing a lot of press from different companies touting their newest stuff. Like Google recently released a whole development package to do this kind of work. And it's a Java development package. And let's be clear that Java and JavaScript are completely different things, which is normally pretty complicated for people. Java is also known for a really bad experience, even though it's got some wonderful side effects. Let's go ahead and jump to this book. Didi, I know that you're kind of an admirer of Cameron's site and blog. Can you ask the first question about the book or about JavaScript?
Well, so I've been late to hopping on the JavaScript bandwagon because of former abuses like pop-up windows and all of that. And now that there's this shiny new toy, Web 2.0, whatever you want to call it, I'm wondering really where I should get started. Is that addressed for like the intermediate developer in your book?
Our book's very much aimed at the intermediate developer. So, yeah, people like you who've sort of been once bitten, twice shy. So you know the old technology, you know that it's gone through its bad phases and been abused really badly. And now, with Web 2.0, people are starting to come in, but they're going, right, I know all this old stuff, but how do I create the new stuff? And that's the perfect niche for our book. So if you've got a little bit of knowledge there and you've got a bit of programming background, this book will tell you exactly how to go about what you want to do.
I got to say that I've been doing JavaScript for quite a while, even making better UIs for websites, which is kind of what Web 2.0 is about, and user interfaces, that is. And this book is a wonderful collection. It's basically the right way to do a lot of things that you seem to end up doing a lot. Like, for example, popping up new windows. I mean, I know that sounds normally, it's kind of a bad thing because we all think of pop-ups, but there's a lot of great reasons to do it. And this book kind of covers a whole bunch of wonderful things. One of the things that I ran into it as a web developer, I just loved it when I was reading it late last night, actually. The idea that you can actually check for CSS attribution to every element on a page, what the actual current CSS is. Now, it's done differently in Internet Explorer versus Firefox, but you've got a quick script that allows you to check either of them. Basically, a script allows you to check the CSS styling of an element, irrelevant of a browser. And that's actually a big part of why JavaScript's been so complicated, is this idea that browsers are really different and treat JavaScript differently. Can you tell me about it, a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's one of the misconceptions that we really try to get around in this book, and that's people are so used to writing for Netscape 4 and Internet Explorer 4, and they just had totally different models of working with JavaScript objects and also the HTML page. But while everyone was busy ignoring JavaScript because it was so evil, the standards have really improved, and at this stage now, you can probably write about 85% of your code and just have it run cross-browser straight out of the box. And you just need a tiny bit of browser customization for a few couple of points. And once you learn those, you can quickly code up a script and have it run cross-browser without without any problems.
Cameron, can you move your microphone away from the breath of your air? It seems to be popping a bit. Let's see if we can get that a little bit better. Cameron, one of the things that I got on this, and this is one of those things that's kind of a generic frustration among people, is this idea that a website sometimes detects who you are, what you are, and then gives a response of, I can't help you. And that's really a horrible response. Most of the time, it's very technical, like, you know, your browser doesn't support the correct scripting, get a better browser, which really doesn't help the average person. You address this a bit in the book. Can you talk about this problem?
Yep. The new sort of web development framework is to really focus on accessibility and usability at the same time, as well as offering really great new features like Ajax and that sort of thing. So it's very much a three-layer model. You've got your HTML, which is your basic data, then you have your CSS, which is your visual display, then you have your JavaScript, which sits on top of that. So you've got those three distinct layers. And normally what you should do with the JavaScript is provide a really static HTML layer that people can access no matter what user agent they've got, whether it supports JavaScript or not, they can access your data. And then if they do have JavaScript turned on, you go, cool, okay, we can offer them these new features. So we'll just add it in seamlessly and they'll never know the difference. So you've always got this layer there that's accessible by screen readers, all sorts of other accessibility agents. And then someone comes along with JavaScript and they get this really cool experience, very fluid. But you've always got the data there so people can access it no matter what.
Cool.
Wow. Yeah, I'm noticing something in the book here. You're talking about accessibility, and I am so glad that you have that in your book. A lot of times when people talk about programming, you have the geek factor where you want to play with it, you want to try out different things, but then you forget about the portion of the audience that may not have fine motor control to be able to, you know, click two mouse buttons at the same time or really fast, or be able to see what's going on. For example, you mention if a pop-up window comes in, the screen reader for someone who is visually impaired would not be able to note that it's a new window. And so they try to hit back and there's no back in that new window. I'm curious what other areas you thought were important with regard to accessibility. I've seen a great section here. Just wanted to know more about that.
Yeah, James Edwards, my co-author on the book, he's a really big JavaScript and accessibility proponent, and this section in the book is probably one of the biggest sections you'll ever find on JavaScript and accessibility. And he goes through a whole host of stuff in there. But I like to sort of characterize JavaScript accessibility sort of three areas. So you've got your non-JavaScript accessibility, so people can access your pages without JavaScript. Then you've also got your device-independent JavaScript, which is being able to access your pages with a mouse, with your keyboard, or with any other sort of device that someone might visit your site with, say, a control stick if they've got limited movement. Then the third area that you have to be worried about is screen readers. So screen readers are this technology that people use if they can't actually visualize a screen. So a blind user would use a screen reader, get the software to read the page out to them. And catering for keyboard users and screen reader users is one of the trickier areas in JavaScript, but we sort of tackle a few of the issues in the book.
Yeah, you have on your site, you have a great collection. People really want to see what this is kind of about. You can go to themaninblue.com or go to geekspeak.org and take a click on his site. You've got some great tools that you've kind of developed over time for different purposes, and your blog is pretty humorous regarding them. One of them is like a drop-down box which you can use your keystrokes for. One of the things that's really frustrating when you're trying to do a form online with just your keys and not your mouse are drop-down select things. You can actually select them, but once you hit the enter key thinking, I'm choosing this choice, you submit the form. That's a standard thing that happens. And one of the scripts that you have on your site, I think, allows the actual use of the form element correctly with a keyboard. So that's kind of cool. So you can play around and kind of see why these tips and tricks are useful, and it's some kind of neat tools. TheManInBlue.com. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at BusinessWithPleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Our phone numbers, are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. We'll take any questions or comments in technology. I'd love to ask have some questions asked about web development, because we seem to have a little bit of information on that right now. But you're welcome to call us with any kind of questions about technology. Again, the phone numbers are 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877.
Esalen's Gazebo Learning Project has rescheduled the Magic Outdoors, a family event, for Father's Day, Sunday, June 18th. Barbecue and listen to music while the kids play games and have fun in the beautiful surroundings of Big Sur overlooking the Pacific. Information is at 667-3026 or online at esalen.org. Am I saying that right, you guys?
Yeah, esalen.org. Yeah, that's good.
Good deal.
There's a second one. Yeah, sure.
Oh, look at this. At KUSP.org, you can find the commentaries that KUSP airs on First Person Singular each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also find information on how you can submit commentary for First Person Singular on KUSP.org.
All right. This program is supported by Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam, Drew Meyer, and Sean Cleveland. Over the Skype line, I've got Dee Dee Hubbard from New York and Cameron Adams, author of the JavaScript Anthology. He's in Melbourne, Australia. We are taking your calls with questions and comments about technology. You're welcome to call us now. And let's go ahead and say hello to Judith. Judith from Watsonville, I believe. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, yeah. I was calling. You were talking about a technology that when you instead of the whole page changing and only the certain part of it changes.
That's right.
And I was wondering, there's a number of sites. I do some like online shopping and stuff like that where it seems like it takes forever for the whole page to change. And I didn't know what I should recommend to them about. This would be great if you could use this.
Okay, it's called JavaScript, is the technology we're talking about. It does take quite a bit of expertise to get it to work correctly. If they're a web developer and you want to get them, you could recommend Cameron's book. It would definitely get you started on it.
And the name of the book again?
The JavaScript Anthology, 101 Tips and Tricks and Hacks. Is that right, Miles?
101 Essential Tips, Tricks, and Hacks.
There you go. And you can also learn about it from our site, geekspeak.org.
Okay, great.
All right, thank you so much for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like we have an email from
product placement, Lyle.
Oh, you're welcome, Cameron.
It's like we have an email from Peregrine Jones in Santa Cruz. Let's see here. I'm very interested in slim computing, basically having most of the computing work happening on the web servers, mm-hmm. enabling very slender and portable client computers like PDAs with Wi-Fi. How does Web 2.0 fit in with this? That's a great question.
Cameron, can you answer that?
That's actually a great question. With AJAX, so I think with the previous caller, the word that you're looking for is this thing called AJAX, which is AJAX, which is an acronym. You don't actually have to know what it means. But that's the technology that allows you to update a small part of the page without having to do a paid refresh. And that's also great for PDAs and small devices because they can send a request off to a server, get the server to do all the work they want, so all the heavy computation, and then the server can send back a little status message or a little slice of HTML, and we can just update the page, a specific part of the page, without having to download heaps of data. So
yeah.
It's great for that.
And you're talking really about two different things going on here, is that one, those PDAs, the Web 2.0 movement of having little applications and web pages is great. But without the AJAX aspect, you'd be doing a lot of bandwidth. And, of course, for PDAs, bandwidth is a serious problem. So this allows you to do a lot less communication with the server, which is a big part
of
it.
Well, in some cases, you're doing more communication with the server, but you're doing
less data.
Well, yeah, you're having a lot of small pieces, and you're allowing more interaction with the client so that people don't have to wait as long for that.
Yeah, so it's probably a good thing. What about JavaScript on these devices? Do you see a lot of JavaScript in these devices, Cameron?
Yeah, PDA support is really, really patchy. You can't be certain that you are going to get JavaScript support, but it's really one of the areas that could most benefit from it. particularly mobile computing, the sort of stuff that you can do while you're out and about on the town, having JavaScript on there would be really useful. For instance, I saw this app the other day that grabs real-time train data from Dublin, tells you exactly where trains are on the tracks in Dublin, so you know whether you're going to miss a train or not, whether you have to run to the station. That'd be awesome to have on your PDA, because you could just check your PDA, see how much time you got before the train's going to pull in, and stop off for a coffee or a donut on the way.
Yeah, nice. All right, and there's a lot of those kind of services exist. That's really one of the real exciting parts of the Web 2.0 movement, if you will, is it seems to be growing a lot more fun applications like that, things that actually work. A lot of mapping stuff shows up. Or we get an email from Alex from Lake Forest, Orange County, and Alex asks that he's heard about Ajax being less secure. It's having security problems. Is that true, and if so, why?
I don't think it has any more or less security problems than traditional client-server messaging, but because it's such a new technology and a lot of people are just jumping on board without really understanding or testing it, it's going to be they're going to create holes and not know exactly what they're doing. So you have to make sure that when you jump into this, you do understand what's going on and you do prevent some of these loopholes that people can attack.
Are you seeing people talking about it being less secure? And can you give an example of why it might be?
Quite a few people are doing form submissions via Ajax, but not doing it using the correct protocol. So there's these things called get and post, and one is relatively safe for deleting data, but the other type isn't. So get isn't a good protocol for deleting data. But if you have all these Ajax requests being fired off using get commands, and it's going to delete data, it's going to make it much easier for people to hack into your database and manipulate the data that's going on.
Right, and when you say delete, it's just we're talking about a get is heavily cached. In other words, that data remains there, whereas with post, you do it once, and then that's the end.
It's also the concept, Miles, that the post and get are supposedly two different things. A get really shouldn't change any data in the world, right? A get is just saying, I want to read that information. Mm-hmm. A post is saying, I'm changing things. So when you delete an entry on your blog or something, and you're doing that with a get, you're just using the wrong protocol. But Ajax, of course, only supports get, because it's an XML
and
request.
And
Oh, Drew's getting bored.
Yeah. Sorry, guys, you lost me there.
I'm sorry, what? Did somebody say something?
Sean toned out, too. Okay.
Yeah, there was also that question about security, and it's a good thing. I'm glad that people are worried about security, and more people should be. But at the same time, going to a website, you can very much think of it as if you're going to a store or calling someone up on the phone to do a mail order. You do have to just do that initial thought of, who am I talking to?
Right.
How much do I trust them to do the right thing?
Right. All right. And, of course, Ajax does support SSL. So if you're on an encrypted site and your browser's not giving you a warning about it, it means that it is encrypted and you are only talking to the server. Okay, let's go ahead and go to Jeffrey in New York. He emailed a question in. It seems like JavaScript is starting to become more standardized for movement of elements on pages, moving things around. And he's curious about the application's approach to building websites and if it's going to take off, what's its future?
How do you imagine what he means by the applications approach?
I think the idea that websites are almost like client applications using ActionScript, using Flash, if you will. Using Ajax. Do you see this as something that's going to grow? Is there like a terminal point where it's just going to stop?
No, I think the number of applications that you're going to see on the web is just going to continue to grow. Things like Gmail, Google Maps, Flickr is almost a little bit like an application. But as Ajax begins to be more well understood and more people get on board, there's definitely going to be a whole bunch of apps. And I think Microsoft and traditional desktop application developers will have to be worried about this, and probably are right at this moment, because Google has bought up a whole host of applications that can basically replace Microsoft Office entirely through your browser.
Mm-hmm.
So this mobile application area is definitely going to grow.
Yeah, but both Microsoft and others have made provisions for this. Like, for example, Microsoft's XAML technology, XAML, which is their XML-based user interface language,
sure,
but for desktop applications. And the Mozilla Foundation with Firefox and their Zool Runner technology being able to make markup. So I guess it is changing the way applications are being developed.
Well, we had a show, I think it was April 22nd or something like that. You can read more about this on the site with Think Free Online, who has a web application word replacement. Word, I think, and they also do Excel replacement. But basically, they allow you to edit, create, save Word documents through a web browser, and all you need is Firefox. And there, of course, you're using this Web 2.0 Ajax technology. It is definitely changing, but I think that one of the things that's going to be pretty clear is that there's, no matter how good websites, web pages get, or the protocols get, there's still going to be a major difference between visiting a website and visiting your local machine. We've heard for years that it's going to move more to the network space and all that, but there is like a major idea that if you're using a server-side thing, somebody else has your information. And we see, for example, in China that Yahoo is delivering over information about its users, which wouldn't happen in this country the same way. And it's all about that information is actually on somebody else's server. It's not on your local computer. And there's some issues regarding that with privacy. Sean?
I want to get back to JavaScript.
Oh, okay.
JavaScript. So if somebody, you know, wanted to add JavaScript to their website, let's just say they wanted to make their dropdowns look prettier, that sort of thing, or work better. What tools would you start with? How would you go about adding JavaScript to your HTML code?
Depends how involved you really want to get. As I mentioned before, the web development sphere has really moved on in the last 5 years, and they're very much pushing this entire separation between the data, the HTML, and the behavior, which is JavaScript. So JavaScript classically just does interaction and changes the way people interact with a page. So if you're going to add something like, a drop-down menu to a web page, theoretically you shouldn't have to alter any of the data on your web page. So you can just grab a script. So for instance, in our book, we've got a whole code library, and one of the solutions in the book is about writing a drop-down menu. So you could take the script that we've got in the book, insert it onto your web page, and it should be able to read the data on your web page and automatically convert it into a drop-down menu.
All right. Okay, I like that idea.
So you can copy this stuff directly out of your book.
It depends upon how someone's licensing it. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's pretty open licensing on our code on the book, so you're free to take the examples and do whatever you want.
And in the book, you actually have a whole links to downloads of all the code that's in the book. So it's really quite easy to start using this code and reusing this code.
Yeah, it's great. You can just every single piece of code that you see in the book is in the code library. So you can just take it onto your computer, fiddle around with it, change it, screw it up, revert back, do all sorts of debugging.
Cameron, I wanted to ask you about WYSIWYG. I mean, I see a lot of developers, web designers, people.
Hold on, back up. Oh, WYSIWYG. Yeah. What is WYSIWYG?
Thank you.
What you see is what you get. It's an idea that, especially when you're dealing with HTML stuff, you don't actually need to look at the code. You can use something that looks kind of like Microsoft Word or page layout program. And
things like Front Page and Dreamweaver are examples of WYSIWYGs.
Right, and the output of that, when you save it, is actually HTML, and it looks the way you were supposed to look. So it is what you see is what you get. It doesn't really work. And one of the things I was kind of curious about is that the support in, like, let's say Dreamweaver, which is one of the major apps for this kind of work, the JavaScript for image rollers and such is really horribly messy. And I'm wondering your take on how that's affecting web development.
Dreamweaver and tools like that are a bit of a bugbear of mine. Personally, I code everything in TextPad, so I'm getting straight into the code. I didn't do any visual previewing or whatever, because particularly with CSS, Dreamweaver hasn't really caught up with CSS. So if you want to visually style a page and you want to do really complicated stuff, Dreamweaver just doesn't cut it.
Yeah.
And it's the same with JavaScript, really. Their JavaScript libraries, I don't think they've updated in about 5 years. So if you're going to do image rollovers and menus using Dreamweaver, I really wouldn't recommend it. There's a whole bunch of other scripts out there that you could use. One of the companies that's really pushing this new wave of accessible, usable JavaScript is Yahoo. So Yahoo had this thing called the Yahoo User Interface Library.
Mm-hmm.
And basically they've created a whole bunch of widgets that you can just grab the script, put it into the head of your HTML page, and like I said, with the drop-down menu, it'll just run, go through your data, find all the correct elements, and convert them into these new JavaScript elements. You can click on them, have expandable trees, drag and drop items. And Yahoo is offering all this as open source, freely available to everyone. And it's a really good framework for developing what you need. So
great.
Stray away from some of the old school traditional desktop apps and just sort of have a look around on the web and grab some scripts and have a play around.
And Didi is actually right now kind of editing our website for the today's show, and she's going and trying to find these links that we're mentioning. I want to try to get us back on target and actually allow everybody to understand what's going on. I think the best way to do that is to invite you, the listener, to call us up, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877, or use the internet. Visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'm going to give those phone numbers out in a second. Let me just suggest that you can call about any question you'd like. We can answer anything on GeekSpeak. We might be wrong, but we can definitely answer it. The phone number is 831-476-2800. Again, in the 831 area code, 476-2800. Or toll-free in California, 1-800-655-5877. One more time, 1-800-655-5877. And Rick Philman, our phone answerer, will answer you. Pipe us in, and you'll be on the air with a person in New York, four people in California, and someone in Australia. Let's get back to Sean. You had something, please.
Yeah, compatibility with browsers. Is that an issue with JavaScript?
It's a tiny bit of an issue, mainly for legacy browsers. So if you're going to be working with IE5 or 5.5 or, you know, some really old versions of Netscape, then that's something you really have to worry about. But with most of the modern browsers like Safari, Internet Explorer 6, Firefox, Opera, they're all pretty interoperable. So you can just write code and have it run on every browser without having to do much code forking. There is a little bit, and you have to know a couple of the nuances, and that's where a book will help you out. It'll be able to tell you exactly which browsers do some sort of implementation. But 85-90% of your code can be done without catering it for a specific browser.
We got a question from Salinas from Richard. Is there a way to put JavaScript into an external file, like an external CSS file, so that it doesn't interfere with the search engine optimization of your site? First off, does JavaScript interfere with search engine optimization?
No, I don't think it really would, because most search engine spiders wouldn't have any JavaScript capability. So if a Google spider visits your page, all it's going to do is look at your HTML. So it won't really affect any SEO that you have on your page. It may affect it if you're putting inline JavaScript into your pages, which is a bit of an old school thing, something you really shouldn't do. So if your HTML has all these JavaScript functions in it and on-click handlers and all this other junk, a spider might be affected on your page.
So Richard's question is really apropos. There is a good way to do JavaScript in a bad way, and the bad way can really kind of affect search engines. So the good way of this external file thing, can you put all the JavaScript in an external file?
Yeah, you pretty much can. There's a couple of issues that we go through in the book about finding particular elements on a page you want to work with, but it's fairly easy to get around. But theoretically, you can just put every JavaScript file into the head of your page, and they'll run fine. You'll get all the maintenance benefits of having the external file, and it's just like CSS.
One of my philosophies about why this Web 2.0 movement's launched so well is that people like yourselves are making these like libraries and references to allow people like me and Miles and maybe even Sean to add JavaScript and more functionality to their website. Not you, Drew.
I can tell.
And that's great, because there happens to be a lot of people out there that understand HTML and understand to some degree JavaScript, and they've been doing some of this work for years now. But wouldn't it be nice if we had a development tool that made this stuff seamless and easy and allowed anybody to make a better website like this WYSIWYG concept, but for JavaScript? Do you see a possibility in that, or is there going to be like a fundamental hit and we just will always have to have this kind of coding expertise?
It's probably a bad idea, because that means I make less money from consulting to people who have JavaScript. But, yeah, there's a lot of libraries coming out. Like I mentioned, the Yahoo stuff, Google has its own stuff, and there's a whole bunch of other people that are putting out JavaScript stuff every day. And their aim is to make it much simpler for you to do stuff. A really good one is this thing called Scriptaculous. And Scriptaculous allows you to add any number of effects to your web page. You can have stuff zooming all over the page, sliding in and out. Mightn't be a very good usability thing, but it sure is fun. And it's really, really simple to add to your page. You just go effect.explode and specify an ID. And whenever you click on that object, it's going to explode or do whatever action you want. So that's something that's really easy to jump into.
Yeah.
But as for automated tools, like something like a Dreamweaver thing, I don't think that'll ever happen because it's just too, it's too complex.
All right.
Probably, I think probably the closest you might get is a really closed environment. So I know the Flex for Macromedia Flash has something similar along those lines. You can build entire applications inside Flex.
Is Flex, though, just a Flash thing, or is it a website thing?
Yeah, Flex is pretty much a Flash thing.
Yeah.
What's Flex?
Flex is an application produced by Macromedia that allows you to...
Now Adobe.
Now Adobe, that's right. That allows you to do...
Macrodobia.
Macrodobia. I want to welcome people to call in questions and comments. We'll answer any question you may have. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or 1-800-655-KUSP. And, you know, we definitely are talking a lot about website development, but please feel free to call about hard drives. You know, I mean, we are here. We have amazing expertise in the room and over the internet. Phone numbers again, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877.
We can talk about how cool MacBook Pros are if you want.
Yeah, did you get one?
Oh no!
Yeah, I got one about my iBook exploded about 2 weeks ago, so I had to buy a new one.
I had to get a new. I'm guessing like a top of the line one.
If Sean and I weren't out of the conversation before, the gate's just been slammed shut on us.
Hey, no, you know the.
Did I hear my name called?
Wake up, buddy.
The thing is, are you? It seems to be kind of a scary time to buy a new Mac laptop. I mean, isn't this the first rev still of the Intel in the Mac laptop?
Yeah, it hasn't been treating me too badly. I mean, I've only had it for 2 weeks, so I can't really say much about it. But
and since you had a G4 Macintosh before, this thing's amazingly better.
Yeah, definitely. It's so much faster. The only thing that annoyed me was 2 weeks after I bought it, they released the smaller version, which is really what I wanted. But I'm happy with my shiny little titanium beast.
Okay, from Carmel, we've got Bill on the call, on the line. Bill, welcome to GeekSpeak. Oh, sorry about that. Hi, Bill. What's your question?
I listen to your show rather regularly, but I'm usually in my car when I'm listening, and that doesn't give me any proximity to the computer. Now I'm sitting in front of my computer.
And now you've got questions for us.
I have. I use Outlook Express for email.
Okay.
And I use Firefox for the browser.
Good. You're half right. Go on. Just kidding.
Pardon?
go on. Your question?
And then, okay, so then I wanted to use the Mozilla Firefox email.
Yeah, Thunderbird.
And when I do that, it asks me if I want that to be my default browser. I say yes, and then it when I call for email, it gives me the message bad password or unknown username.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to try to use Opera email, it gives I make it the default, and then it tells me POP3 server unavailable.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're not configuring the mail settings on the new email clients. And that's not a... It's basically part of the process of using a new email client. So when you use a new web browser like Firefox, you didn't really have to do anything except for maybe...
I can't hear you. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Can you hear me now?
Hold on. Wait a second here. Now I'm getting some noise out of my computer. Okay. Yeah, now I can hear you, I think.
Okay. You there?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so one of the things when you get a new email client, you have to configure this all the settings. When you download a new browser, there's no real settings to configure. It just works. But for email, you really do have to know your username, your password, your mail server information, and all that information comes from your internet service provider. So one thing you can do is you can go into Outlook Express, because you've been using that, and see what the settings are for, you want to see your POP3 settings?
I've done that.
Okay, and you've copied those over to your new application? The error that you're getting from Mozilla email client sounds to me like you've got the password incorrect on your account. That's all. So I would what I recommend is start trying to guess a little bit about what the password is. And if you have an original email from your ISP, they can tell you what it is. You might not ever need to know it because it's been saved for so long. Does that make sense?
I'm sorry. I'm just having so much trouble hearing you. I just am not getting... Yeah.
Okay, well, it sounds like we're not going to be able to answer this over the phone. Why don't you go ahead and send us an email. Go to geekspeak.org and click on our contact us, and ask us through email. We'll help you out. Thank you so much.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
By the way, I've gone to settings in Outlook Express, and the POP3 seems fine, and we don't use a password, and... no password.
No, you definitely use a password. So in your new email client, you do need to know that password. I'm going to have to go on, and if your Outlook is still working, please do send us an email. In fact, you can do it through just a web form. Thank you so much for the call. Okay, we're going to go ahead and go to Jim and Hollister. Now, I just want to remind everybody, actually, because of Skype and technology and all that stuff, Dee Dee and Cameron cannot actually hear you, but we can hear you, Jim. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. We currently have Comcast cable broadband. They had an introductory rate which sort of seduced us in there, and now it's close to 100 a month, and we're just about to switch over to DSL, but I'm wondering if I might not be making a switch that I'll regret. Is it correct that DSL goes over a telephone line, so that if you have... we have a big home, and I thought since the telephone line is already wired to several rooms, that we could use two or more computers simultaneously on DSL. Is that correct?
It doesn't help you out any more than cable. In fact, in both cases, if you have a large home, I'd actually recommend you get a home gateway kit that has wireless and then send it off to each room. But if you're going... You're talking about $100 a month with cable.
Well, that's because of all the services that cable has, right?
Right.
It gets bad. As the introductory rates are great, and then as you go further, especially if you don't really want cable television, you've got all this expense just for your internet connection.
Right, but for the same amount of speed for DSL, you're talking about the same price for internet access. So you may go cheaper with DSL, but you'll be getting a slower speed.
Do you like cable television today? Do you love it? Jim? Do we have Jim?
I can just barely hear you.
Sorry, Jim. Jim, do you currently like cable television? Are you using the cable services for television?
We could probably do without it for at least a year. It's gobbling up too much of our time.
Okay. Well, what I recommend is, first off, no, you'll be fine with DSL. It will be pretty much exactly the same as cable. I'm going to have to say goodbye because we've run out of time on GeekSpeak once again. I'm so sorry about that. Please do send us email. We'll answer your question even more inadequately. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. We were talking today on GeekSpeak with Cameron Adams, the author, one of the co-authors, along with James Edwards, of the JavaScript Anthology, 101 Essential Tips, Tricks, and Hacks. You can read more about the book from our website, geekspeak.org. Click on today's show, which, of course, is May 27th. Thank you so much, Cameron, for waking up at 3 a.m. in Melbourne and talking with us on air.
My pleasure, Lyle. Thanks for having me.
So it was a real pleasure. And Dee Dee as well, thank you for joining us from New York. I appreciate both of you joining in. For Rick Philman answering the phones every week on GeekSpeak, thank you so much. And for Miles, Drew, and Sean, of course, always, I welcome you and appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. To those who called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it'd just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence, used by permission. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Please stay tuned for Castle Cottage, but first we're going to have the Slow County Report. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP Santa Cruz, KBH San Ardo, on the web at kosp.org. For KSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.